Hi, everybody. Welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. Although we've taken a lot more lately to doing pairs of movies that are basically related. And they're not always one good movie, one bad movie. This week, we chose to watch Breathless, the landmark Jean-Luc Godard film from 1960. And it's a kind of obscure, little remembered 1983 remake, American remake, starring Richard Gere, of the same name. And I guess we didn't decide before the show which one we were going to talk about first. But as far as, you know, a good movie and a bad movie, I think we might disagree on this one, but I found the American remake to be pretty enjoyable, and the original, which I remembered enjoying, you know, when I saw it years ago, I just found this time around it reminded me of everything I don't like about French movies, which is that they're too slow-paced and they're boring and they're pretentious.
You mean the 35-minute conversation they have in the bedroom was not something you enjoyed? No, because I've tried watching Breathless before and I've never watched an entire Godard film. And it's like watching Breathless, I'm like, I remember exactly when I turned this off 7 years ago. Like, and I mean, the second one, Breathless, the remake is amusing in sort of the, oh my God, it's so awful sort of way. Because it's Richard Gere acting like a tough guy, which is
Richard Gere is pretty awful.
I mean, true. It's always amusing actually, if you look at it, you know, Godard's moving camera is amazing. Like, I don't know how he did that. I mean, some of it I'm like, that's got to be handheld because you'd see the tracks, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, Breathless, the remake's directed by Jim McBride, who's not a bad director. His next movie was The Big Easy, which is sort of somewhat forgotten now, but for at least until Dennis Quaid's Coke bust in 92 or whatever, it was like a big... It was very well reviewed, very well received. It's a great movie, and you know, he's not a bad filmmaker, even though I question a billion and two of his choices in Breathless. But it still makes for great discussion fodder. I mean, it's like disrespectful like to the original that it's amusing. I mean,
I don't know. It wasn't as disrespectful as it could have been, but it's kind of a weird... I'd like to read some reviews of it, and I wish I had before we did this. Like, Ebert's review, I'm sure, must be a howler, as they usually are. But,
you know... look it up while you talk. Yeah, go.
Supposedly, you know, critics hated this movie, and that just kind of makes me mad, not because the movie isn't, you know, worth panning, but because, like, it's just too easy to pan a remake of a, you know... the original French New Wave film that everyone knows, and, you know, just pan it like for not being that movie. Because it had been like a number of years since I had seen the original, I watched the 83 one first and kind of tried to go into it as the average moviegoer in 1983 might have, you know, not knowing that it's a remake or anything. And like on its own terms, it's a fun movie. It can't escape its pointlessness because the story of the original, which it's actually fairly faithful to, is so pointless. So I'm not sure what disrespect you mean. Stylistically, it's very different, but the story is pretty much the same. And even though the story is kind of a pointless one, you know, it's just a fun movie. And for God's sake, at least it like moves along.
Well, that's true. That's what's so funny is the two of them are about the same length. Except the second one does not have the 30-minute conversation. And if you haven't seen Breathless, and Ebert actually calls Breathless the birth of modern cinema, it goes from Citizen Kane to Breathless to, since it's Ebert, I'm going to guess, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and then to The Phantom Menace or something. It's Breathless is the greatest film since whatever, but... And he actually gives the second one 2.5 stars. But no, if you haven't seen Breathless, Well, one of my big problems with Breathless that I didn't even get to the first time I watched it, well, first of all, I don't think Jean-Paul Belmondo's a good actor. I mean, he swaggers around. He's like, you know, the French equivalent of Antonio Banderas, except Antonio Banderas eventually grew into someone who could play with that idea and be amusing and charming, whereas Jean-Paul Belmondo's, you know, he's a disaffected Frenchman. Oh, his life is so terrible. That's the other funny thing is they're on these awesome Parisian locations, and I just kept waiting for them to bitch about how, like, we live in such a beautiful place. It just sucks. You know, whereas the remake's in L.A., and it looks like, I mean, it's, you know, they don't really get all that seedy, but it's still L.A. I mean, it's not, like, great or anything. And whereas, you know, in the first one, they're, you know, going under the arch, and they're, you know, walking along the river, and you're just like, it's just so miserable. But no, Jean Seberg, the woman in the first one, they never really comment on it, and I don't know if it's a point of the movie, but her French accent, because she's an American in France in the movie as well as the actress, her French accent's awful. It made me want to claw my ears out listening to her speak. And so there's a half-hour scene where they just sit around and talk to each other.
And, which was, like, revolutionary in 1960, but, you know, the influence of this movie and the other European New Wave movies is that now there are tons of arty independent movies made by dipshits who just have their characters talk about nothing forever.
I mean, the thing is like, I mean, this was really revolutionary when it came out, but it kind of needed to be reappraised because I'm trying to think of, you know, 1960 in Hollywood, you would have been, what would you have had? 1960.
I don't know, a lot of musicals. Light Psycho. Romantic comedies.
Well, I mean, you know, you had Psycho, you had...
Yeah, but Psycho was very different.
And you had Spartacus, but even Spartacus was still sort of a jumping point. I mean, Spartacus was Kubrick's most traditional movie, and it was, like, what, his sixth movie? But yeah, you also had, you know, Ocean's 11, right? You had...
I kind of think of that period, like, kind of the... almost the whole decade of the 50s, actually, but maybe in particular the mid to late 50s is, like, probably being the cheesiest period in Hollywood history because, like, the wheels were coming off the bus and they were just throwing more and more money at stuff to compete with TV. So you had, like, lavish – everything was big and lavish and huge – unnecessarily huge casts and stuff.
And Elvis and Presley was, like, making movies. I mean,
oh, yeah. Well, enough said, right? Elvis movies. So, you know, something like Breathless, obviously a breath, breath of fresh air.
But yeah, so the remake does not have that half hour. It has, I think they actually do manage to make that scene about 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think you see more of Richard Gere than...
I mean, cock.
Yes. Actually, I did because I knew it was coming and I'm like, I'm not looking. Because I'm like, I've already seen his ass six times in this movie. Like, I don't need to see his cock too.
Isn't it hilarious how, like, they cast Gere in this because he was a sex? You know, they were, like, trying to make him into a sex icon at the time or movie sex symbol. I mean, I don't know if he was or if it was just, like, several movies attempts to, but it was basically because, you know, I'm sure he got this because of, like, Last American Gigolo. American Gigolo.
American Gigolo, An Officer and a Gentleman, right? Was that, like, the next year? Which I've never seen. I think
that might have been the same year as this, but yeah, Richard Gere was considered, like, you know, a dashing romantic lead, but he's not. But I mean, I think in those movies he was playing more of, like, a sensitive type, wasn't he, than the character in this?
Yeah, I mean, he's a clown. I mean,
yeah,
the character
in this is like a buffoon. Yeah,
in the first one, in the original, you can be like, well, okay, he's a sociopath. You know, it's sort of interesting because he's a sociopath. In this one, the cop shoots first. You know, it's just like, Greedo shoots first. You know,
I was wondering about that, and I couldn't quite tell, and I decided that they, you know, filmed it ambiguously so that I could decide that he shot first. But yeah, they in the original, it's quite obvious that he shoots the cop in cold blood. And in the remake, there, you know, Richard Gere is at least partially acting in self-defense, so he's allowed to be a little more lovable.
Yeah, and they, like, really
when he's singing into the shower head and stuff later.
Oh, when I said disrespectful, I meant the fact that they made the title the fact that Richard Gere walks around during the movie going, "I'm breathless."
Oh yeah. He's singing a Jerry Lee Lewis song in the car near the beginning of the movie.
But breathless. No, he actually refers to himself as breathless when he's talking to the girl at one point.
Oh yeah.
But he's also obnoxious too.
quoting the song back at her.
That's one of the other things is he's obnoxious in a totally different way. And this one he's you know, he busts into her school.
I know, it's like a
presentation.
He's
a jerk, you know.
But he's like a sitcom jerk.
Right. Well, I mean, the first one, I guess, if you were writing an essay about film, you could argue that it's interesting because it's actually not interesting, but you could say it was interesting because it's this American girl who goes to Paris and sort of. She devalues human life to the point where she's agreeing with her cop-killing boyfriend and stuff like that. And in the new one, it doesn't have any of that. There's name-dropping about Errol Flynn. I mean, it's just, you know.
Yeah, you can see why Tarantino really likes this movie. And he has been quoted a couple of times in a couple of publications about
really
liking
this movie.
What's so
funny is that if you watch the first Breathless, most of Tarantino's early directorial moves are from that movie. The walking around, the very long tracking shot while people are doing... I mean, it felt like Pulp Fiction.
You know, what's funny, though, is, like, I think he takes stuff from both movies because, like, there's so much rear projection in the remake.
And it's bad.
But I think it's bad on purpose, but that's still a weird, like, seemingly random choice because it's not like he's... doing an homage to the original Breathless, having a rear projection, because the original Breathless has a lot of driving around, but it's all real location stuff. So it's like, is he doing it to do an homage to? I don't know. It's like he's doing it as an homage to people who wouldn't. It's like he's doing it as an homage to French New Wave for people who wouldn't get actual references to French New Wave, but would think like, oh, rear projection, just like in all those French New Wave movies. Yeah, clever.
Which wouldn't have used them whatsoever. I wanted to read something. I had to track it down because it was hard to find. Back when, Rocky VI came out, Stallone did a bunch of interviews with Ain't It Cool News where people emailed in questions.
Yeah.
And so somebody emailed in a question and said, hey, so, like, what's up with the Lords of Flatbush? Share an anecdote. Now, the Lords of Flatbush, which I've never seen, I think it stars Stallone and the Fonz. And it's from, like, 74, but apparently Richard Gere was originally in it, and he got fired. And so every time I think of Richard Gere as a tough guy, I always think of this story. So I'm going to read this story, and then we'll actually get back on topic. So this is Sylvester Stallone talking about this.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not going to do a Stallone voice, but... Okay, here we go.
You're not. Okay.
I don't know how my Stallone... Yeah, so... Okay, anyway.
No, please.
Okay. Yeah, the original part of Chico, which was played by Perry King, was originally supposed to be played by Richard Gere, but we never hit it off. He would strut around in his oversized motorcycle jacket like he was the baddest knight at the round table. One day, during an improv, he grabbed me, we were simulating a fight scene, and got a little carried away. I told him in a gentle fashion to lighten up, but he was completely in character and impossible to deal with. Then we were rehearsing at Coney Island, and it was lunchtime, so we decided to take a break, and the only place it was warm was the backseat of a Toyota. I was eating a hot dog, and he climbs in with half a chicken covered in mustard with grease nearly dripping out of the aluminum wrapper. I said, "That thing is going to drip all over the place." He said, "Don't worry about it." I said, "If it gets on my pants, you're going to know about it." He proceeds to bite into the chicken, and a small, greasy river of mustard lands on my thigh. I elbowed him in the side of the head and basically pushed him out of the car. The director had to make a choice. One of us had to go, one of us had to stay. Richard was given his walking papers, and to this day, seriously dislikes me. He even thinks I'm the individual responsible for the gerbil rumor. Not true, but that's the rumor.
I forgot about that rumor.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like... So, I mean, that's what I always think when it's like Richard Gere, like, being a tough guy. And he did a bunch of these movies where he's a tough guy. He did this.
Yeah, but,
he did
but
Blood
isn't his character in like, American Gigolo a bisexual? Doesn't he play bisexuals and stuff?
Well, yeah. I mean, and he's, I think he sees cock in that about 30 times too. I mean,
you can't have it both ways. You can't.
He was in Pretty Woman. I mean, like, the guy's best performance was probably in what, Runaway Bride? Like, I mean, it's just like he's a joke. And I mean, I get the whole.
Women
like Jeff Chandler because he had the premature gray hair. Richard Gere had the premature gray hair, whatever. But like watching Breathless, you're just kind of like.
He's also got those naturally squinty eyes that women love.
Yeah. So, I mean.
It's funny. The tagline for the remake on the poster was, "He's the last man on earth any woman needs, .. and every woman wants." So they were like really trying to sell him as like a dangerous, sexy bad boy,
which really isn't in the first one. I mean, in the first one, you know, he actually has to beg the girl. I mean, that's like part of the half hour scene. It's him begging her for 15 minutes of it for sex. I mean, Richard Gere basically just has to take off his shirt, climb around an apartment building making ape sounds, and she just, you know, can't resist him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess the movie makes a little more sense, or feels like it has a little bit more of a point. Because, I don't know, considering that both movies are about this car thief trying to get his girlfriend to flee the country with him, and she's, like, you know, taking too long making up her mind, I can sort of buy her taking too long making up her mind if she is really into him. But in the original, it's all just kind of arbitrary. Every character's actions are kind of arbitrary. Whereas in this one, they really, you know, harp on, like, oh, this guy's really in love with her and she's really in love with him and doesn't know it yet. And that's why we've got to see these two crazy kids ride off into the sunset together.
What's so funny about that one scene, though, when he... Because, I mean, they really do follow each other, like, point to point. It'd be funny to sit down and put them together and see how they sync, just to see where they make up time and lose time. I think there's a chase scene in the remake that probably makes up some of the time they didn't spend on the big, long conversation. And that's kind of the thing about the first one is, if it was just some movie where, you know, if it was, what, My Dinner with Andre, where they were just sitting around talking, if he was begging her for sex for 90 minutes, it'd be a better movie. Because you wouldn't have to deal with the fact that it's dedicated to Monogram Pictures, and Monogram is kind of like, if Columbia was a Poverty Row studio in the 30s, Monogram was a Gutter Row studio in the 40s, and so it's like dedicated to these crappy film noirs. But the thing is that instead of coming up with some weird symbol of crappy film noir, it's like he's modeling his life on Bogart. And that was the other thing, that in the first one he's modeling his life on Bogart, 15 years removed from Bogart. Right?
Yeah.
In the new one, he's modeling his life on Jerry Lee Lewis, 25 years removed from Jerry Lee Lewis. And it's just like there's a huge disconnect where it's like it doesn't have the same emphasis, like replacing them. And I don't – McBride made a movie – he made Great Balls of Fire, so I think he liked Jerry Lee Lewis or something. So I don't think he inserted him in there as the placeholder, which the movie kind of needed of sense.
Yeah, but in the original, isn't there only one scene where he walks by a Bogart poster?
He looks at the picture for 3 minutes of the runtime going, bogey. Wait around. Shot of him smoking, bogey.
Okay.
In the new one, on the other hand, when he talks to himself, when he's really, you know, breaking the fourth wall, it works a lot better in the new one because they sell it better.
The remake overall like actually makes the effort to sell you on things, whereas everything in the original is just kind of an affectation and very French. But like in the remake, it's like his infatuation with the Silver Surfer is something that's
very interesting.
It's really hard not. It's hard not to like. Put it that way.
First of all,
he's like reading aloud from a Silver Surfer, you know, a Jack Kirby like vintage '60s Silver Surfer comic, in the very first scene, and you know, and the camera is panning over the art, and you see the little dots on the in the ink, and you feel like you're watching the opening credits to Flash Gordon again, and he's reading aloud, and he's like, yeah, you tell him, you know, Silver, and. And then he, you know, stuffs the comic book in the glove compartment or whatever. But then it shows up again, like half an hour later.
Yeah, and he talks to his girlfriend about it, and it's just like,
yeah, wasn't it a freaking great scene where he's reading and you know the same comic or a different comic at the newsstand, and like a little punk kid comes up.
Oh yeah,
and like,
that was hilarious.
Man, Silver Surfer sucks. And like the kid tells him why Silver Surfer sucks, just like a comic book nerd would. Like, you know, he's got all these powers. Why doesn't he just leave the Earth and gear
is
all
serious?
That's what
the streets of LA are like, right?
I mean, hey man, he doesn't leave Earth, you know, just because he's got the power cosmic, because blah blah blah. And you can just hear a young Tarantino jotting down notes that. Characters need to talk about comic books.
I actually think that it would work better if they had casted somebody like Stallone in Breathless, the remake, because he can do stupid so much better than Richard. I mean, Richard Gere, you know, he just does bad acting. He doesn't like do I'm stupid. And, you know, it's like you don't even get that deep into the character to think about the guy not being that bright. But, I mean, yeah, no, like, if you could have really gotten into it and, I don't know, but... I mean, I'm sure, you know, if it wasn't Richard Gere, it would have been John Travolta. I mean...
Yeah,
that actually brings something up, that Days of Heaven, the story with Days of Heaven, is that Malick really wanted John Travolta for some reason. And when he got stuck with Richard Gere by the studio, who loved him, even back, you know, 5 years before Breathless, they were trying to make him into a star. He got so pissed off, he cut all the dialogue from the movie because he didn't think Richard Gere could do it. And so you have Days of Heaven as it is now. And it's kind of like, you know, every time I see a Richard Gere movie, I kind of understand, you know, hey, if I get to do it, I'll just cut all my dialogue so this guy doesn't get to butcher it. I mean, well, that's the other thing is that, you know, the whole Silver Surfer thing is new to this. And I don't think I've seen...
Yeah, characters weren't talking about comic books in a serious way, even in 1983 in the movies.
No, and the only other movie I can think of that really actually does something like this is The Ice Storm, when they, you know, The Ice Storm is all set to a Jack Kirby Fantastic Four comic, and I don't think that's in the book. I don't think that's in the novel. I think they added that from the movie, and...
That's comic book fan and future director of the Hulk, Ang Lee.
But now that I've seen Breathless, I wonder if he got the idea from Breathless. Because, I mean, they use it in a very similar manner. And it's Kirby 60s stuff, except, of course, for the Ice Storm, it wasn't 10 years after you wouldn't have been able to buy it on the street. Which is the funniest thing, I guess, if you know anything about comics, is that, yeah, you couldn't have bought his Silver Surfer comics.
Yeah, they weren't
in 1983. Yeah.
Well, yeah, but that's just one of those things. That's one of those things about the remake that's like kind of innovative. Actually, that's the thing is that it's got like some innovative stuff in it that almost feels like it's homage to what was in the original movie, but actually it's like new stuff being tried out that you see in other movies later on, like the deliberately fake rear projection and comic book discussion, and also the soundtrack, because yeah, it's really cheesy that, you know, he listens to the Jerry Lee Lewis Breathless song and sings it to himself, but the soundtrack is pretty cool and it's pretty like carefully thought out, and yeah, there's another song called Breathless on there somewhere that they use during the credits. But
I thought that was just a 80s cover of the Jerry Lee Lewis one.
Oh, no, yeah, you're right, it is. But I don't know. I like the soundtrack, I guess, is all I'm saying.
I wonder if that was Blondie, because, of course, Blondie did...
I don't think so.
Okay, so a little bit more about the original. So, as I try to think of it in terms... But, yeah, it's... I guess the female character's a lot more complex in the first one.
She's not really like a character at all in Breathless.
Which one?
She's The remake. Yeah. I think in the remake, because sort of like her character comes from her not being sure about this guy, and she is sure about him. She's a lot more sure about him in the remake, but not in the original.
And then the other funny thing in the remake, which is sort of it's weird to talk about the two because you just sort of go back and forth. So in the new one, she just loves architecture. I mean, she goes up to some guy and she's like, "Oh, I just want to build beautiful buildings." And
yeah,
make the best
that's what
buildings.
That's what she came to America to study.
Just building beautiful buildings. In the first one, she's meeting some author about his book about whatever. So he's like a French novelist, and it's another 8-minute scene where it's just very.
It's snappy French answers to stupid questions.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just so funny that they didn't even give her that much. It's like in the remake, they were like, well, she's French. That's all we need, is that she's French, so she's complicated.
Yeah, and it's a play on, the original.
And,
it's,
yeah,
it's
they reversed
an
the
American
two.
American in France, yeah.
But the other thing is, in the remake, she's not necessarily pregnant, whereas in the first one, she's pregnant.
That's true.
And then, what else is there? I mean, there's
in the way of homage to the original?
No, I was just thinking about how the character's different between the two.
Yeah, well,
In the first one, so basically she turns the guy in at the end in both movies.
Yeah, she does that in both, yeah.
But in the first one, she turns the guy in because she, makes an empirical observation of her emotions that she does not actually love him, and so she should not, be his Bonnie.
No, it's like the other way around. It's like, I just called on the police. I just called the police on you. I guess, therefore, I don't love you.
Yeah, I could do it, so I don't love you. But then in the remake, she sees herself in the paper. And so there's this scene where
it's completely self-serving.
Because she had to build beautiful buildings.
Yeah, her parents aren't gonna send her more money to go to architecture school if she runs off to Mexico with Richard Gere.
Yeah, who's sorry, I was gonna start on a Richard Gere tangent again, but I think
it's not that the character in the original isn't a shithead. Also, it's just that they're different kinds of shitheads.
Yeah, I mean, in the original, he's even worse. I mean, in the original, he's a dangerous. I mean, he assaults a guy in a bathroom for some money, and I mean, in the remake, it almost seems like he's going to.
In the remake, he steals Bruce Valanche's purse.
Yeah, and it's just. The teeth have been taken out of it in the remake in a way that...
Yeah. Actually, that's very true, although a way that they actually make him... I don't know. It's almost like they're trying to compensate at the very end for his being more toothless than the original guy. The last shot of the remake is he turns around and he shoots at the cops, whereas in the original, he's running... A friend of his tosses him a gun, but he doesn't use it, and he runs from the cops, and the cops shoot him in the back.
Yeah, of course, I sort of saw that in the new one that, Jim McBride's like, we could make it like Butch Cassidy, or something, just like...
Freeze frame of, he's obviously about to die, but it kind of made, I was kind of ambivalent about his character, I mean, Richard Gere, despite all the unfunniness, but when he turns around and shoots the cop, I was like... Wow, this guy's just as sociopathic as the original character, I guess. If he's willing to do that, because he's probably going to get his dumb girlfriend killed. She's like standing right there, and he's creating a shootout
in front of Errol Flynn's mansion, where they slept in the car. And that's kind of the other thing is that in the original, the guy Belmondo is able to convince. Gene Seberg that he's not just some loser. He's like, I only stay at this hotel, and they were all booked up, so I had to sleep at your... I broke into your apartment to sleep here. Whereas in the new one, it's like, Gere's like, where was he going to stay in L.A.?
The Wilshire or something.
Yeah, and you're just like, no, you weren't. Like, and it's just, and if she believed him, you're like, you're an idiot. Like, you deserve this guy. Like, I mean, that's kind of the problem is that it's so unbelievable that anybody would fall because he's so clearly a schmuck.
Mm-hmm.
And but, that's And then they develop his job in the and how much money he's gonna make in the second one. Did you notice that? Where they no. make it really literal, like how many thousand he's gonna get, like, you know, $1,900, and that's what they're gonna run away to Mexico on. And I'm kinda like, wouldn't you need more than that to do it for any period of time? But I guess not, but I don't know.
I didn't notice that so much. What I noticed more as far as his, you know, the crappiness of his plans on to get to Mexico was the fact that, you know, what is it? Like, there's that scene where the girlfriend sees the cop and she distracts him long enough for him to grab a car and they drive away. So now the cops know that, you know, he's out there, and that's really like when he should start heading for Mexico no matter what before he gets picked up. But instead he stops off at this party, and yeah, I know it's to get his money, but I mean, like, that's where the cops find him. That was a dumb move. And then when they get away from there, he still doesn't keep going. They go to spend the night in Errol Flynn's backyard.
Because he's waiting for his check to get cashed. That's the big thing in this movie.
What a dummy.
He's got his boss paid him in check. And in the first one, I kind of got the impression that it was from some illegal venture. In this one, it almost seems like, you know, he tempted a travel agency for a while, and, you know, he's just waiting for his check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Which is, and the first one's not, it's not like it's very well thought out in all of its stuff. So that really says just how unthought out the second one is in,
I've always found it kind of amusing that the original has, like, well, it's not co-story, is it? It's like story by, Truffaut. Yeah. I mean, but what is the story? It's a guy is on the lam. And he wants his girlfriend to come with him. I mean, you could sort of do anything with that. I mean, where the personality of the movie came from in the original was, you know, all of the conversations Jean-Luc Godard recorded with his one-night stands and then transcribed into the screenplay. Breathless, like, you know. What I liked about the screenplay for the remake was that they, you know, I noticed it was Jim McBride and L.M. Carson, Kit Carson.
Yeah.
Who famously adapted Paris, Texas, and for horror movie fans like me, he wrote the script to Chainsaw 2, which is brilliant. But what I liked about this one is that, like, you could really tell, like, he just took his favorite lines from the original. Mm-hmm. Like, and they're just as they're just like little inconsequential character details, but if you're going to do a remake of Breathless and actually, you know, have it move along at some kind of pace and not have a 35-minute bedside begging for sex conversation, then yeah, that's the way to do it. Take your favorite lines and then, like, just have him visit a few more places so that he has some, you know, some more stuff to do instead of hanging around the girlfriend's apartment for so long.
Yeah,
and some of the lines are really, like, you know, memorable, and you can understand, like, you know, this is why I liked noticing the lines, because it helped me understand, like, why people like the original so much and why, you know, why some people would have wanted to remake Breathless in the early 80s, you know, who would have, you know, because these would have been people who, you know, enjoyed it, you know, near when it came out and were sort of fans of that era and kind of were fans of it in its original context, whereas we're sort of a step or two removed from that now.
Right.
But hearing the lines in the remake and in the original, you're like, oh, okay, this is why people dug it so much, because of, you know, genuinely clever lines, you know, like, you know, oh, you know, girls like you sleep with everybody, with every guy except the one who really loves you, and, you know, oh, I'm trying to shut my eyes so hard that all I can see is black, but I can't do it, and, you know, the stuff about, like, a woman's toes are very important. These are all just, you know, these are all just little...
Yeah, in the first one, that one particular scene, the toes thing, works a lot better than when Richard Gere does it. I mean, that's, like, the thing, is that the first one has... They basically cut most of the girls' lines from the 30-minute scene and keep all of the They keep all of the callous statements from the guy. And
you know, that's actually a huge difference between the two, is that Breathless is so much more about Richard Gere. I guess that's kind of what we've been talking about all along without saying it. But yeah, they pretty much eliminate the girl's character as much as possible from the remake.
But it's not like that Richard, they somehow make Richard Gere's character particularly interesting or anything. I mean, it's not like, it's just they remove her from it and add a couple chase scenes and then you've got your runtime. They cut out the point about him being married, which was interesting in the first one. I mean, well, you know, arguably, that the guy forgot that he was married, still legally married and stuff like that. And it, but I think that, what is it? The line about when she's like, why don't, you know, you said you didn't come to LA because you have so many enemies here. And it's just, it just seems silly, you know, like what Richard Gere's enemies, who are Richard Gere's enemies, like.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a line from the original.
Yeah,
I think you
picture Richard Gere like in a hairstylist battle or something, you know, it's like.
Yeah, sure.
Shampoo.
Gay Puerto Rican hairstylist has it out for him because he stiffed him on the tip or something. I really liked the when they repeated the lines about you know, oh, I've got to have my car done, you know, it's a foreign job, and then like the girl is across the room and she's like, you know, foreign job, what do you mean? He's like, I'm talking about the car, because that works with that works with both actresses.
Yeah, and one of the other things in the original that isn't there at the beginning when you meet Gene Seberg but gets more amplified throughout the runtime is that they don't, and they repeat some of this in the remake, that they don't understand the language, so they'll be like, well, what does that mean, and what does that mean, and so it makes a big deal at the end of the first Breathless, because what is he calls her stupid while he's laying there dying on the street,
calls,
or something.
He calls her a louse, yeah, and then the last line of the movie is, you know, what's a louse, and I was going to ask you, like, if you thought that she really doesn't know what that word means, or if she's like making a point.
No, I think it's Godard being a, you know, pretentious douche.
Oh, okay.
Basically,
yeah.
Yeah. I think most of the choices in the movie are that, but they don't.
Well,
they
sure.
don't repeat that in. But and she's talking to the camera too. So I mean,
right.
Oh wow, it's just so, you know.
But again, like, I can't get too mad at that. In the context of the time, it's a lot different than Elvis Presley. Right, it's very different. You know, in the first few scenes where the guy is like driving a stolen car, he starts looking to the passenger side and talking into the camera like we're sitting there in the passenger seat, and that must have been exhilarating in 1960.
That's also different. The whole driving scene when in the remake and in the original. In the original, the guy gets pulled over by the cops because he gets pulled over by the cops. It just sort of happens. In the remake, Richard Gere does something stupid to get pulled over by the cops.
Oh, he does something stupid in the original too, doesn't he? He's pulling off-road around that truck.
I thought that was in the remake. Does he do that in the original
no,
too?
No, that's in the original. He drives off-road to pass a truck illegally, and that's why he gets pulled over.
He does that in the original too?
Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. See, I thought it didn't really register in the original. In the new one, it's got, you know, the... Because I think in the original, it was all from the driver's POV, whereas in the 83 one, McBride's got to give you the establishing shot because Americans can't handle, you know...
Well, that's funny because that didn't actually register with me in the remake. But...
Really? Oh, because in the remake, it's at night versus at day, and oh no, it looks like it's Maximum Overdrive for a second. I mean, they're like, he's going on the shoulder, he's cutting in front of the truck. I mean, yeah, no, in the original, it just sort of got sort of lost in the, because I mean, that's a very frantic scene in the original, and I guess that's part of. I don't know if that's why people like the original. I don't think I've ever read a review of it. I've never had the interest. But there is a certain frantic attitude towards some of the movie that it's like, well, maybe it's called Breathless because it just runs around all the time. But
yeah, that's true. Yeah, the meaning of the title. I mean, the irony, I guess the irony is that, you know, we keep harping on the 35 or whatever minute stretch of the two of them in her bed. But yeah, the rest of the movie kind of clips along, and part of how it does that is by doing a lot of jump shots, which was a technique that became synonymous with French New Wave movies. And it's like right from the beginning, like when he's driving, like, I can't remember, he's listing off stuff. I think he's listing off like places, for some reason. And with each place that he names, the shot jumps to somewhere else. So it's like, you know, the back of his head is pretty much the same, but the scenery keeps jumping and changing forward. It was either at the beginning of the movie or at the end when he's driving around with her. But yeah, a lot of, you know, those jump cuts are something that I remember I liked when I saw the original for the first time, because it's not something that you see commonly done now. It hasn't become cliche or anything, and it grabs your attention for sure, and it kind of forces you to pay attention, like, you know, keep watching or you might miss something else here. And they jump around too in the bedroom scene, but only like once or twice at the very end, but, you know, to catch you off guard, to kind of keep you on your toes. I guess that's the idea. What other Godard movies have you seen? I've only seen like,
Ones have I tried watching? Yeah,
I've only seen Weekend, which I remember I liked mostly because it's so absurd. It's almost like a John Waters movie. But then I saw Contempt, which people say is one of his best, and I found it, you know, abhorrent, not abhorrent, just stupid and boring. And it's also got like a half an hour long scene of two people bitching at each other.
Let me see.
And I think those might be the only two. So it's not like I'm going off of a wide breadth of titles to quantify his style with, but his style does include long stretches of people talking, and that's not cool. I mean, call me an American without an attention span.
Well, I mean,
I just don't have the attention span for that.
What's his face? Tarantino must love him. His production company's named after one of his movies.
Oh yeah, A Band Apart, right?
You know, I think actually Weekend is one of the only other ones I tried watching, and I didn't make it. I don't think I've ever tried to watch Alphaville. I've never tried to watch Contempt or any of the other ones. He only worked for about 18 years. I mean, he made a lot of movies, but...
Yeah, and actually, like, looking at his filmography... Like,
He continued later. I'm sorry, I was...
Well, he's still working, I mean, to this day. But all the movies that made him famous, like the titles that people talk about, those were all within, like, a less than 10-year period, pretty much beginning with this. And, you know, before 1970, he had already, like, made his last movie that people still remember and talk about. I think it might have even been Weekend, which was like 67.
Yeah, I think that is kind of the last one. I've heard of Detective, but I don't think...
I don't know. I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, I mean, it was just an 80s one he did.
I remember in film school, a professor showed us a 1985 movie that he did called... I don't remember what it was called, but I guess it was about a girl who gets... immaculately concepted and the church freaks out, and I didn't go to class that day, but that's how you know he's beloved by film academia, because they'll actually play his movies out that were made after the 60s.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, yeah, we had a similar response on the podcast to Cassavetes in some ways, that after, when you're looking back at these people, you know, what, 40, 50, 60 years removed, you're operating way too much in their wake to really understand.
Yeah, you have to, like, constantly remind yourself what it was going up against, what else was happening in movies.
I mean, it's like Jurassic Park, right? Like, when Jurassic Park came out, it was awesome.
Yeah, if you showed a kid Jurassic Park now, they would just think it was like a movie that came out last week.
Yeah, and well, there's way too much intelligent dialogue, even.
Except for all that. But yeah. as far as the dinosaurs go, yeah.
And they're not actually doing enough crazy shit in some ways.
Yeah. Okay. So,
But still, I understand your point. Star Wars, you know, I mean, that was like Lucas felt the need to go back and change up all his Star Wars, and you know, it's to make these things seem fresh while you're operating, you know, mm-hmm. when they've already made their contribution to the I don't know. I sort of was. I was going on Breathless until the conversation. I mean, I was like, I wasn't enjoying it. I hadn't really changed my opinion from when I turned it off, you know, long ago. But I was like, I can do it. I can just sit here and I can do it. And then I'm like, holy shit, it's been 6 minutes. No, it's been 14 minutes. I'm like, this is just, you know, and I mean, Seberg's really kind of awful.
He only has one mode, and it's surly.
No, not Belmondo. Jean Seberg, the girl.
Oh, the girl. Yeah.
I mean, I just think that if the point is that her accent's supposed to be terrible... I don't know. I mean,
maybe that's funnier if you're French and you get to laugh at the stupid American.
But are you supposed to laugh at Breathless? I can't tell. I mean, that's the other thing.
I think so. I mean, because really, I think the tone of the movie, despite, you know, and it actually kind of makes it disturbing. But you've got this sociopathic character and this, you know, pretty vacant and self-serving girl that he's into, and you know it. The tone of the movie is kind of one of like, who cares? It's very, you know, there's a reason that The Stranger was written by a French guy. Like, the movie is very pro pointlessness, and doing that long ass dialogue scene is almost like, a message that what we need now in movies is not lavish production or anything, but just pointlessness, because that's truer to life, and it's cinema verite, and that's why we're carrying the camera around under our arms, and to bring you into the realism of this couple's life. And don't you, you know, Hitchcock did that long ass tracking shot into the window of a building to set you up for the idea that you're peeking in on, you know, people in their underwear just like in real life. But Godard just sticks the camera in the bedroom and lets it run for a half an hour.
What's interesting, though, is if they really did stick the camera under their arm and walk around with it, they didn't do that in those scenes. They did that in the scenes that were, you know, the most traditional. I mean, okay, so if you remove the whole, not even the entire romance angle, but if you want to talk about Breathless as some kind of a film noir thing, which is a problem because most film noirs do not. The protagonist is still a good guy, right? Like in Out of the Past, Robert Mitchum, still, he's a better guy than Kirk Douglas, right? Or whatever. And in this one, you know, he's the worst guy in the movie. Nobody else is quite
The police aren't even like, you know, in the remake, they kind of give a little bit of character to the police so that they can be more of antagonists, but... In Breathless, they're not even developed as antagonists. Yeah, the main character is the worst guy in the movie.
Yeah, and so it's just this really weird sort of film noir that, it gets to the point where it just can't. It's just so pointless after a point, because if the first, I mean, that was, I watched the first one and then I watched the remake, and in the remake, they talk a bunch about the check and how he's got to cash this check so he can get out of town and all that kind of thing. And the first one adds all this gravity to the character and all of his smoking. I mean, if you have to count how many shots you have of Belmondo smoking in the first one, it's got to be... God. Anyway.
Yeah, the French are really, at the time, I guess, and always, really in love with smoking. True stereotype.
And so know, it's just, it just, it doesn't have any real content, but it doesn't, it's...
Yeah, I think that's what we're getting at, is that, like, the style was very innovative for the time, but there really isn't any substance behind it. Like I said, the story, the quote-unquote story is so slight that they had to, it was an effort for the remake to have it, play out the same running time and not have that long-ass dialogue scene. It's the original was style over substance, but at this point, like, that when the style isn't as arresting as it once was, especially not 50 freaking years ago, it's a chore to sit through now.
Another interesting thing about how they treat the women between the two of them is in the remake, I don't know if you noticed this, the girl sleeps with her professor.
Oh yeah, in the original she doesn't.
But he's also not even her professor in the original. In the original, he's just some guy who's helping her out, trying to get her jobs doing. He works at the newspaper.
Right.
He's trying to get her jobs doing stuff. In the remake, though, she's sleeping with her professor and lying about it. I mean, it's just really weird how,
I think the difference between the two is that the remake isn't aware of how little it thinks of women, whereas in the original, Jean-Luc Godard lets you know how little he thinks of women. Because there's that scene where, the girl goes to some press conference with the writer, like you said, and a bunch of the questions that they ask the writer are about, men and women, and he's very hard on women.
Especially...
And of course, the main character... she completely betrays the guy at the end.
Now, I think in the press conference there's also some line about how, is it that French women are better or American women are better?
It's something like that, and his answer is like, well, in America, women dominate their men, and here, not yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I always got the sense that that's
Godard.
That's Godard, yeah. And, he does kind of have an equivalent in the remake, except it's not a long scene. It's like a very, very short snippet of something. But it's like a famous architect instead of a famous writer.
And which doesn't quite have the same gravity. I mean,
Because what do you
really
ask a famous architect?
Let's ask the famous architect about gender.
Remember when the girls in the remake, the girl's professor is taking her to his hotel room or whatever, and he's like, "Boy, some hotel, huh? Frank Lloyd wrong, am I right?" what a corny ass line. that line was old, when Frank Lloyd Wright was still alive. But what other architecture jokes are you going to make with a girl who's studying architecture? I don't know.
Yeah. Of course, the girl in the new one, I don't think she ever really... She was French, and I don't think she really did a lot of other movies in the U.S.
No. Nope.
That's one of the things is, it's Richard Gere, it's 1983, you'd think you'd recognize some more of the people, but you really don't.
No, that's the thing. I joked about Bruce Vilanch because he's literally the only, other name in the credits that I recognized. He's Manon Stahl, whose purse gets stolen by Richard Gere.
Yeah, the cop is one of the cops that gives a really bad performance and screams and bitches about, stuff, is played by John P. Ryan, who was in Five Easy Pieces and some other things, but he's not really recognizable. And so basically you're left with a movie where, your two film presences are Richard Gere and the French girl, and you're just... her professor wasn't even recognizable, and I thought that at least they would have gotten somebody mildly... it was supposed to be a hit, right? Like, it was a studio picture. Supposedly, Michael Mann was working on it, and he left it to go work on his awesome movie, The Keep. But, it brings up the question that you kind of raised earlier, is why the hell was anybody remaking Breathless in 1983.
It's just, I mean, I can understand, you know, I'm sure, because they were fans, I'm sure, but it's still, it just as a loot, I think it's just as much of a, it would be, I don't know, would it be more or less of a losing proposition if they were going to remake it again, like today? Probably more, right? But it was still
it was still
really obviously a really bad idea then, almost as bad an idea as Psycho 2, which also came out the same year.
I don't know. At least if you're going to make it today, it was produced by Barbara Streisand's producer. Breathless was.
So who would produce it today?
Who went on to produce Ernest movies?
Oh, well, I like those.
Ernest Goes to Camp era, not the first one. But anyway,
That was the first one.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Sir.
Yeah, you can't really get that on a lot of other podcasts. You can't get people getting snippy about Ernest movies. No, I think that if they did it today, well, James Hong was in it. I actually recognized him, the grocer at the end. I think, you know, if they did it today, they'd do it on video. They'd make a big deal out of it. They'd try to get in some, maybe some they'd have French
Yeah. No, you're right. They would exploit they would try to add that indie movie flavor.
Yeah.
I mean, but wait, I know when the best time to have remade this would have been. The freaking 90s.
Exactly,
The fake indie movie movement.
Right, it would have been
Tarantino,
a great...
and Kevin Smith and Miramax would have produced
perfect.
It.
Perfect. It would have been perfect for that. Yeah, Especially...
But you couldn't do it now, and you couldn't do it in the 80s.
Or in the 70s. You wouldn't have done it
or
in the
70s.
Because they would have been like, why don't you just go see the original? I mean, that's the other thing is it's like... What is it? The question of why you would remake a movie comes up a little bit with this one because they don't stick to it enough that there's a point in remaking it. They don't change it enough that there's a point in remaking it. I mean, they could have just taken the concept of the original. Some guy, a sociopath, kills a cop and is on the run and he's in love with this girl. And this is what happens. They don't do that. They follow it point to point, add some chase scenes, trim some scenes, but they basically follow and add some sitcom silliness. It, like Richard Gere getting a stupid outfit, which was just this idiotic scene where he gets, you know, these dumb pants that he wears for the rest of the movie. So, I mean, it's not like... that kind of remake either. So, I mean, I think that's what my question is, because it's not like the director had done something before it that would have gotten him this role. So, obviously, Barbra Streisand's producer really wanted to make this movie.
Yeah, looking at his filmography, like, the last movie he directed before this was, like, almost 10 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so.
McBride.
McBride
did a lot of... that I think David Holzman's Diary is, you know, some landmark 70s gay movie. And then he did this, and then he did Big Easy. Then
I didn't know it was a gay movie.
Yeah.
But Carson wrote that. They were a team on that as well.
Okay. And that
one actually sounds really good, reading a description of it, like a fake documentary about a guy who's, like, you know, just narcissistically documenting his life. And it makes fun of, like, the early documentary filmmaking wave. It sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Selected by the Library of Congress, I think.
Breathless would be selected for other reasons. Yeah, and then he sort of did Big Easy, then he did Great Balls of Fire. Great Balls of Fire bombed. And then he, you know, he did some TV, and I'm not even looking at his filmography, I'm just remembering it. And then he did a movie called Uncovered that was never released here that was based on a sort of Spanish thriller, and I saw it because I read the book in a lit class once, and it was like early Kate Beckinsale, and it's just a train wreck that you're like, it's just directed incompetently, and I don't know what happened to him in between that he sort of went that route, but no, I mean, Breathless is like, his filmmaking is good. I mean, the rear projection, I disagree with it because I think that he doesn't really make the rest of the movie feel like that.
Yeah, but I agree. He's a very good director.
Yeah. He does a lot of stuff that Godard can't be bothered to do, like good establishing shots.
I guess we didn't talk about Godard enough in this episode, but that's one of the suspicious things about Godard's career is that, like, you know, well, you know, some people would look at the way he directs his movies and call it amateurish, but if you're doing something amateurishly on purpose, it becomes style. But then if you're doing something amateurishly on purpose, you have to ask, you know, if you were going to do it less amateurishly, could you do it?
That's,
you know, is it really an artistic choice, or is it just your own lack of skill?
That's the big question.
That you decided to turn into an asset.
Yeah, I never had a professor say this.
Because this guy was a film critic for Cahiers du Cinéma before he was a director, and that's a big complaint about his movies in general, is just that, you know, they're not like real movies; they're like intellectual exercises.
Yeah, and
they're designed to make you think, not to make you just get like sucked into the experience of watching a movie.
And I'm sure there have been lots of term papers written about the conversation in Breathless. I mean, but still, I don't think I'd want to read any of them.
And also, just based on Weekend and Contempt, it's like he does the same tricks over and over. I mean, those other two movies do have like long ass scenes and, you know, dialogue scenes in bedrooms and jump cuts and you know, breaking the third wall and all the same stuff that was in Breathless. He repeated himself a lot after this movie.
And you know, I like the talky stuff. I just think that in Breathless, too much of it. I mean, the problem is that he's dealing in caricatures, and how interesting a caricature can be when they're spouting off philosophically. They get stopped out really quick.
Tarantino does it better.
Yeah, but that's a scary thought. But true. But, yeah, no. Hey, there you go. The Inglourious Bastards in the basement cafe where they're talking for 10, 15 minutes.
Uh-huh.
That's a better scene than the 30 minutes in this by far. Hell, yeah. That's one of Tarantino's best scenes ever. But no, I mean, I think when he's moving the camera, it's okay. I mean, the direction's decent in the first one. Like when he's the tracking shots around. Yeah. Otherwise, I think even the most simple stuff he has problems with. Otherwise, though, like there's a scene in both movies. That's never explained in either movie too. Where Jesse, is he Jesse in the original too? His name in the original just...
No, it's Michelle.
Yeah, that's right. But I always think of him as Belmondo. But anyway, he leaves and the cops come right in after him. Well, in the remake, there's this, you know, he goes down into the subway and comes up the other side and that sort of thing. But in the original, he just walks out the door and they come in after him. And it's just sort of unbelievable that they didn't see him or something.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, he had a the camera was on it was a fixed position shot.
Yeah.
And it's like, he couldn't do it. But the thing that neither movie explains is how the cops ever find out it's him.
Yeah. I never stopped to think about that myself, actually. And watching either one.
No,
it's just the magic of cinema.
And I don't think that in the second one, in the first one, it gets away with a little bit more because it's in France, it's in the 60s or the 50s, and it doesn't seem as tight.
The filmmaking, the filmmaking itself is like erratic and loopy. I think maybe they should have called it Plotless in the original film. If I were a hack, snarky movie critic, Living in 1960. That's what the title of my review would have been. Plotless.
No, you would have loved it in 1960, though. That's the difference.
Oh, no, that's true.
You would have been like, I just saw Ocean's 11. You know, I just had to sit through Ocean's 11, and my friend wouldn't leave. But then, you know, I went to go see this great movie by this guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all right. That's true. That's fair.
Yeah.
Well, does that about do it?
Yeah, actually, I think it does. And this is our first ever mixing the two.
I know.
Movies.
I can't believe it. We managed to alternate back and forth.
I don't know how else you could have talked about either one because they're so contentless.
They're pure style and they're too similar in story that we were just stuck comparing everything. But there you go. All right, well, next episode will be a little more bifurcated. Next episode, we are going to do a Revenge of the Nerds special, the original 1984 classic, and the 1987 sequel, Revenge of the Nerds 2, Nerds in Paradise. And I'm a big fan of the series from way back as a kid, but even when I was a kid, I knew that the original was the only one that was actually a good movie, and the rest were just garbage. But now I'll actually go. Now I'll be able to talk to you about why they were why it went wrong from the second movie.
I've actually never seen these on anything but free television, which means that I've never seen them with the TNA that I know.
Ooh, well,
was there.
Yeah, well, so, we've got Bush, as Curtis Armstrong says.
Well, that's only fair because we got to see Gear this week. So,
well, we got to see the French girl's boobies too, but I mean, it was so casual and natural that
opposed to Richard Gere, who was like, "Look at my butt."
It wasn't meant to be titillating. Where as opposed to Richard Gere, who flips over on the bed in perfect timing to, you know, when the shot cuts, so that we don't see. So that we don't see his cock that we so desperately want to see, that all the ladies in the audience swooned at that moment. Like, aw, they weren't going to show it. They teased us.
Wasn't this movie a huge bomb, though? So basically,
No, it totally was. Anyways, so this is Vin and Alan Smithy podcast. I've been Matt,
and I've been Andrew,
and thanks for listening.
Clouds like a gambling lamps, and I am a breathless over you. And the red-breasted robin beats his wings, his throat it trembles when he sings. For he's a helpless bit for you. And the happy hooded bluebells bow and a bend of their heads all a down. The whispering stream at the bubble and brook, the fishes leap up to take a look, for they are breathless over you. Still your hands, still your heart, still your face comes shining through, and all the morning glows in you. Still your mind, still your soul, for still the fire of love is true, and I am a breathless without you. The wind circles among the trees and it bangs about the new-made leaves. For it is a breathless without you. And the fox chases the rabbit around and the rabbit hides beneath the ground. For he is defenseless without you. The sky of daytime dies away and all the earthly things, they stop to play, for we are all breathless without steal your hands, and steal your heart, for still your face comes shining through, and all the morning glows anew. Steal your soul, and steal your mind, for still the fire of our love is true, and I am a breathless without you.